Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to the first program of the new year. And I'm especially glad to be able to welcome you to the brand new WCNY facility, and I'd like to thank Bob Dano and his staff for allowing us to be here this morning to give us another chance to show off this great new community asset. It's a special program. It's the first of the year. We were also able to reschedule Congressman Maffei, who, as you may recall, was supposed to speak to us in the fall, but was held hostage by some negotiations going on in Washington. So I think maybe this timing will even wind up a little bit better. So I want to remind you, though, that we will be back at our usual location next week. And in the month of February, we have, I think, some great topics lined up and some speakers. Just to give you a heads up, we'll be talking with new directors of some of our arts organizations in Syracuse on the first week in February. Then we'll be moving on to government modernization and the brand new Local Government Modernization Commission. And the co-chairs of that commission will be speaking to us. Then we'll be heading to international issues with some talks about things going on in the Middle East and other parts of the world. And we'll end the month talking trash, as Tom Rhodes used to like to say, with the director of OCRA and the head of the board of directors. I want to remind you that TMR is taped and broadcast on WCNY FM on Sunday evenings, and after that, we're podcast on the WCNY.org website. So that is another thing that we really appreciate with our community partners. Thank you, WCNY. So right now, it's my pleasure to welcome the president and CEO of WCNY, Bob Dano, who will welcome you to the facility and introduce today's speaker. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, and welcome to our new facility, actually your new facility, because as Sandra just said, it is a community asset. It's your asset. So we want you to use it, enjoy it, and get all of the value that you can extract from it. You know, it wasn't very long ago, I would say, a few years ago, that up right above us and over about 9 o'clock, there was about 40 of us standing on the roof just adjacent to this new part of the facility talking about what this whole area could be, dreaming about it and some of the promises that were going to happen here in the neighborhood with various projects going on. And a person standing on that roof that was participating with the belief of the vision and what it would take to make it all happen was our very own guest speaker today. And I think if Congressman Maffei thinks back on the words and the promises and thoughts and of what were being talked about that day, which was a little breezy on the roof, and I'm certain if he could remember, as nobody would move on that old roof, because on the way there and you had to walk, it felt a little spongy. And you look at where the neighborhood is now, where it was then, it is just incredible the renaissance that has already happened. And there's a lot to go, but the momentum that is there is great. It's taken a lot of people to do that, and we've gotten a lot of support from Congressman Maffei. And so it's my pleasure to welcome him here today to share with all of you. So thank you.
Okay. Look, I'm very, very glad to be here. Bob, that was a very generous introduction. I was a big supporter of WCNY moving here and the Near West Side Initiative generally. So many things have happened since Syracuse University, and one of my predecessors, Jim Walsh, really, I think, got behind this project. And I was very glad to support it, and it was a cold day, and I'm very glad to be here now. It is an amazing transformation, but I do have to say, that Bob is modest. I mean, his vision in coming here and being the anchor for this as much as Syracuse University, the two of them, really is a big help. I was just complimenting you. You leave the room as like, well, you'll listen. You'll listen on the radio. So I'm very, very grateful for that introduction. I don't want to talk long. I think it's important for you all to ask questions. I've got so many old friends in the audience. I do have to say that, I speak in front of a lot of different groups on a national level. I, of course, speak in front of Congress. But I'm never more nervous than when my kindergarten teacher is in the audience. Although, Peter, you were the executive. So I don't know. Peter Knobloch is here. But anyway. So my staff gave me a bunch of different pointers for this, and they told me that I needed to be candid and that I needed to be optimistic. Candid and optimistic. So I'm going to attempt to do that. But those are hopefully not exclusive, mutually exclusive in this world. And in fact, lately I think in Congress there has been some progress, and it's been a little bit behind the scenes, a little bit quiet. But we did pass a budget a couple of weeks ago, a very important budget. A very imperfect budget, but a budget that would get us back on a track of funding basic functions, keeping the government open, paying our bills, making sure that our military has the basic resources it needs, keeping people from being cut off of vital programs, and starting to invest in our infrastructure again. I do say it's imperfect because it was really just a start, the very, very basics. It doesn't tackle long-term things like tax reform or entitlement reform or the things that really, really cause the long-term budget deficits, but at least it gets us to a point where we can start talking. We've had other little progress things, too, and even last year, the Violence Against Women Act reforms were passed. They were not passed in the 112th Congress. So, people say, well, this is the worst Congress ever. Well, that's a competition in the last several Congresses. So there are things that are going on. And in a bipartisan way, we've actually seen a number of smaller things go through. The agriculture bill passed the House, broad bipartisan support. Again, we're taking some hits here. The food stamps was cut far, far less than originally thought. And there were a lot of good things in the bill, including, some help for food banks. But it's still a tough price to pay. But it does mean that there are negotiations going on and there is bipartisanship and there is work being done. It is not a completely hopeless situation in Washington, even amidst all the rancor. But there is a lot of rancor. And we still continue to have a lot of disagreements on issues that it seems in the country there's broad bipartisan consensus. And one of the examples, of course, is immigration. I look at immigration and I see really something very unprecedented happening, at least here in central New York. You have labor unions and labor advocates coming together with farms and businesses and universities all sort of saying this system isn't working. We don't need amnesty, that we don't want to create incentives for people to risk their lives and come into the United States and sort of flood the country, but we also need some sort of pathway to citizenship for people who work hard and want to contribute, as most of our ancestors came to this country doing, certainly mine did. And we want to make sure that we have the workers needed to actually create more jobs for Americans here, whether that's on farms or whether that's in universities. When we graduate people with PhDs and things that we desperately need, like engineering or physics or other kinds of sciences, we don't want to send them back to China or India if they, in fact, want to stay here and become Americans and raise their families. So we need this immigration policy. And yet, when the president said we need to reform immigration, he didn't lay out any specifics. He's been criticized somewhat for not laying out specifics in the State of the Union address. But the State of the Union address is really more about broad themes. And all he said was, we need to reform immigration policy. And I was in the audience sitting on the Democratic side, and all the Democrats stood up, and I looked over, and I expected all the Republicans to stand up. It was Richard Hanna. But most of the other Republicans were not standing. And it was, again, I can understand why they would disagree with specifics. And maybe they thought, oh, that means the president, exactly what the president wants on immigration. I don't know. They also didn't stand up when he was talking about investing more in scientific research. those things make me nervous. I don't think those are partisan issues here in Central New York by any means, but I am concerned that we're still having disagreements on some issues like that, at least in that kind of a forum. It doesn't mean I'm going to give up, but it is of concern. And certainly the fact that Congress has appeared to be so partisan on some of these key issues has taken its toll. I am proud to say, though, with the recent accomplishments, Congress is now up to about a 13% approval rating. So, big improvements. Take that, toe fungus. We're much more popular than you are now, by at least 2 percentage points. The reason, by the way, why toe fungus was more popular than Congress is because people said, well, toe fungus will go away. But the truth is that I think there's a real concern right now in the level of cynicism in the country. Congress is everybody's frustration. Certainly, I think what people don't understand is if you serve in Congress, particularly if you're relatively new to the institution, and you know I'm in my second term, you know I'm certainly on the 87% side of that. So you know it's not like you don't have your own disappointments. But I do think it's important to try to make the institution better and not to give up. But there's a lot of cynicism about everything in the media, cynicism about lawyers, doctors, ministers. Nobody is above 50%. I mean, this is the thing. People say, oh, the president said, you know, only President Obama and President Bush have ever been this low in their approval rating. And I say, well, the problem is maybe not Obama and Bush, but maybe you look at all of society and we're all so cynical. And how did we get this way? How did we decide that everything was bad? And you look at the economy and you go, well, yeah, the economy has lots of problems. Maybe that's why, right? But the fact is even amidst all of our challenges with the economy, relatively high, or at least higher than we want on unemployment rate, inconsistent growth, there's still so many good things going on. And actually, we have seen an economic recovery. The challenge, as the president talked about the other night, is we're not kind of seeing the upward mobility that we would want, and we're not seeing the strong middle class that we would want. Although even upward mobility hasn't gotten worse, it just hasn't gotten better like we would want. But still, we're not the Weimar Republic here. I mean, we're not in that kind of a deep, deep, deep trough. So the question is then why are people so concerned? And this is what concerns me. Why have people lost so much confidence in every institution of government, but not just government, businesses too, right? I mean, you've got the Tea Party on the one hand. They think any government is bad, and they still exist in Congress. People who will vote against anything, even if it has a slight bit of government in it, no matter how small. There was an anti-abortion bill the other day that one Republican refused to vote for because he said it still had too much government in it, too much spending in it to help people. This kind of cynicism is countered by the group that decides that anything that business does must be bad because it's business doing it. That banks are all corrupt, that energy companies are all corrupt, that all these things that can be blamed on the private sector. The fact is just institutions are too complex to be that simple. And certainly we're not going to go anywhere, I think, with either one of those attitudes. But they're more and more prominent in American society, and it's becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy because people, ordinary citizens, work hard, raise their families. They're looking at what's going on in Washington. They see division. They're looking at what's going on in the news media, and they see mostly bad news, mostly division, mostly criticism. They see Fox News, and they think, well, that's not where I am. They see MSNBC, and they say, well, that's not where I am. And so what do? They drop out. They drop out. They say, well, I just wish everybody would get along, and they're not getting along, and they must all be, you know, the part of the problem, so I won't vote anymore. I won't participate. I won't volunteer. Why? I mean, you know, and it's very understandable. I don't think anybody in this room, and most of you are exceptions or you wouldn't be here, but I don't think anybody in this room would say that they don't understand why somebody who's busy in their regular lives, ordinary lives, trying to raise their kids work one, two jobs would look at the political system and not say, well, I'll vote with my feet. I'll walk away. But as they walk away, who's left? it's more and more people on the extremes or people who have one particular issue that they're really, really passionate about, but there's, you know, other issues don't matter. And it's becoming that sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. So when you look at the way Congress is and you say, well, too many are way on the right and too many are way on the left, and there's not enough people working in the center and there's not enough people who are willing to talk to each other, because I don't think you need to be a centrist to work in the center. You just need to be willing to not completely stick to one particular ideology because you want to get something done. And that's what people aren't seeing enough of. So, but as those people drop out, again, the extremes get more. And of course, the campaign finance system, the post-Citizens United world that allows the Koch brothers to come in and spend millions of dollars on ads. A friend of mine has a couple million dollars of ads running against him in his Senate race in Michigan this early before the election on health care. So that a big new issue, right? It's been around a long time. And that really changes the system. The fact that there's been a lot of gerrymandering. Most states don't have very, very, very few, if any, districts that are like this district. Could be Democrat or could be Republican. The election doesn't really matter. Maybe the primary election does, but a primary is usually very, very, very low turnout. And so only you really have a very small segment of the electorate in one party or another deciding who the congressman is. But even states, right? We can't blame gerrymandering on states. They've been the same. But there's been this sort of self-gerrymandering where more and more educated people have moved to the coasts. And you know, it sort of is kind of measuring out. So you have red states and blue states. And that's one of the reasons why everybody was so excited about President Obama, because he said red states, blue states, I want it to be the United States. And I think you saw a lot of that in his speech the other night. I was happy to see it. I think it actually had gone away for a while. But now the president is really looking at trying to get some stuff done, I think, in his last several years in a bipartisan way. But he may not have a partner. And that was also acknowledged in the speech. So how do we get out of this? How do we get out of this? Well, I do think there are ways. I've been working very hard in a couple of different organizations in the House. There's something called No Labels, where there's no litmus test, by the way, to what you, we've got Tea Partiers in No Labels, and we've got very, very liberal Democrats in No Labels. But it's one of those things where we're sitting down, we're trying to talk about certain things and trying to find where we do have common ground. And so far, we have found common ground in some areas, two-year budgeting, making sure that that we have the right kinds of green buildings that don't spend money. Strategic sourcing. I have a bill with a Republican from Arkansas, a friend of mine, Tim Griffin, to help that. Now, you don't necessarily hear about this stuff on the news, and we're not talking about the really big things like, you know, taxes or Social Security, but at least we're starting to make progress, and at least we're meeting together every week. Or every week we're down there. There was a group called the Tuesday Group, which met during the shutdown. And this was a group of about 50 of us, about half Democrats, half Republicans. We were joined by several senators. And we essentially started growing this small seed of compromise that eventually led to the deal that did open the government last fall and then led to finally a budget agreement this year. But I will tell you, 25 or whatever it was, there was all rank and file members. There were no, you know, leaders. Nancy Pelosi wasn't there. John Boehner wasn't there. No committee chairs were there or ranking members. So we started small, and, you know, and our first couple of ideas weren't very good, but at least we were talking. But these are the kind of things that we need to do and I think work together. The way I handle deal with this in my own advocacy for Central New York, partly because Central New York is in a place where we've had a historically challenged economy, and also it is a place where we have a diversity of views, and it is a swing district, and I'm proud that it's a swing district. But I work very closely with my neighbors, whether it's Richard Hanna, who happens to be a Republican, or Bill Owens, who happens to be a Democrat, and all of us in upstate. I think if you look at any of those issues, we work closely together. But also keeping a very, very focused beam. And that's why we've got the strengthening the middle class. It's a broad concept, but the fact is that in Central New York, if the middle class is strong, Central New York is strong. New York City and California and other places have super wealthy people. We are strong because our middle class is strong. We have increasing poverty. But if we can improve people's mobility, as the president was talking about the other night, We also, a lot of those poor people have a lot of capacity to go into the middle class. We have a lot of refugee communities. We see a lot of good signs there, but certainly stuff needs to be done. And of course, the focus, when you're focused on the middle class, you have to be focused on work, jobs. The middle class stays middle class. People become middle class because they are working, and they're working in decent jobs. And that's where I've just focused all my energy. We had a job fair the other day. We had 1,500 people there. It's a lot of people. It means that we do have a lot of unemployment and underemployment still in this community. Now, I do have to say, though, that with almost 40 employers, we couldn't have even had this job fair 3 years ago. I mean, we wouldn't have had enough employers to make it worth anybody's while. And we're going to have more of those. We've had economic forums. We've had I've introduced several pieces of legislation to help sort of set a tone and get some ideas out there. And the things I've advocated have always been focused on that. How can we improve the middle class economy, and how can we improve the job situation? And sometimes I've gotten in trouble with the left for some of these advocacy. You know, I'm opposed to some overregulation things. I look at a lot of different kinds of things, like even the tax on the device manufacturing industry, which was a pay for the healthcare bill. It wasn't essential to the healthcare bill. And I'm opposed to that. And people say, well, why are you opposed to that? Don't they make a lot of money? Well, they do a lot of research in the United States, including in this district, and we need to make sure that they continue to invest in those researchers. I get in trouble for the right because I want to support infrastructure development and education. And a lot of these things that sometimes, particularly with education, a lot of the right thinks there's almost no federal role at all or no federal role at all. But again, if the focus is the middle class, if the focus is on jobs, that is where I think the sweet spot is, particularly here in Central New York, but frankly, all over the country. And so in trying to balance the various, you know, the cynicism with the how do you get things done, even while people are that cynical, and even while people may not even notice. I mean, WCNY is a great forum, but my guess is that we're not going to have, you know, over 50% of my constituents hear this when it's rebroadcast. But hopefully a lot of people will. But the fact is that you need to go, if you're focused and you go through this, I have confidence that people will sort of see what we're doing and understand that in a very complex world, we have to move the ball forward. It's so much better to be part of the solution than part of the problem. And that gets me to my last point, which is to compliment you always want to compliment your audience. So TMR, though, is an essential element to getting people back involved. And all of you are part of that. The fact is that we've got a general media, and I'm not talking about anybody specifically, and I'm certainly not talking about anybody locally alone. This is going on nationwide. The media is so driven by getting viewers, listeners, readers, whatever you want to call it, that naturally it's going to give viewers, listeners, readers what they want to hear. It's like a junk food company, right? I mean, if your job is just to sell the food, or whatever, the edibles, you're going to give people what they want. Sweet, you know, sweets or whatever, junk food, potato chips. That's how you're going to get the food out of your vending machine, right? If you put in, you know, really healthy stuff, you know, you don't see any spinach vending machines. So the media gives you what you want. Well, over time, that message is, boy, you are just great. I know I just said compliment your audience, but that's what they do. You are just great. The viewer, listener is just, they're just terrific. And they do get this message over time. And then they go out in the world and like, not everything is going their way. So wait a minute, I got the message that I was terrific and not everything's going my way. Why is that? So then they go back. And again, over time in the aggregate, they get the message from the media, whether it's Fox on one hand or MSNBC on the other, or talk radio or websites, they get the message that, well, it's not your fault. It's the fault of fill in the blank. It's the fault of those selfish CEOs. It's the fault of those corrupt government officials. It's the fault of whoever you want, right? Now, fortunately, we scapegoat so many different groups of people that, you know, we don't have time to get so concentrated that we really break down. But the fact is that is the message. It's a natural thing. It's not trying to blame the media. It's just the function of it being try to get as many viewers and listeners as possible. And if you get a little segment, but they're a loyal segment, that's fine and you'll survive. And so they get that message. And so in many ways, we've become a scapegoat nation, trying to find the next person. Well, this, you know, well, that person should take care of her, that person. That has to go. That's where things like Thursday morning roundtable can make a huge difference, because everybody in this room is in this room because you want to take responsibility and you want to make it a better, and many of you already have, in fact, almost all of you already have. So you're already doing this. But the point is that checking out, going to the sidelines is not the answer. It may seem like it is. It may be so tempting. But in fact, you need to do the opposite. Get more involved. I once identified myself to the newspaper as a radical moderate. Big mistake. But anyway, and I just did it again. But no, but the fact is what I was talking about was the fact that if you want to get things done, if you want things to be in a bipartisan way, if you're willing to let a few things go in order to move the country forward, that's where we need the activism. That's where we need to hear from people. That's where we need people to get people together. Because by the way, sometimes you sit down in a room and you realize you can actually come up with a compromise that does make everybody happy. But the only way that's going to happen is if there's trust. And so we need more trusting people, more optimistic people while they're being realistic and candid, but more optimistic people to get more involved, not less. This is a great country. We've been through very difficult crises. This is a great region. Central New York has always been a leader in progressivism. 150 years ago, we had one of the first conferences on the well-being of the slaves that were going to be released and what would happen to them and how we could make their lives better. And of course, we were leaders in the Underground Railroad. We were leaders in the women's movement. We were leaders in the peace movement. We were leaders in all these different things, in labor and all these other things. We can do it again. And I do believe that this area, and you know, even look at this area, you know, Richard Hanna and I, the cooperation you see with the county executive and the mayor, we can be the leader that maybe gets this country out of this era of cynicism and lack of productivity and into an area of cooperation and productivity. Thank you very, very much, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Congressman Maffei. Okay, I do have a microphone and I will be looking for questions, so thank you very much. I just want to say I really appreciate your message, and I love the bipartisanship that you're trying to promote, and I think that getting people together one-on-one is key. And although TMR is nonpartisan, I'd like to know if we could only get people at TMR to sit at a different table every week and talk to somebody else. I think we would go a long way toward that.
I noticed, Sandra, there's no tables here.
Yeah,
so
I'm thinking this might be a good thing. John?
Maybe we should do Theater in the Round next time. Yeah, exactly, absolutely.
Congressman, I'd like to know how the Defense War Department that we have, that uses so much of the resources of this country, perhaps more than the next 5 or 10 countries in the world, how can we change that so that some of those resources are being put into infrastructure or education? And I ask that question because we talk about it when we're at war, but as soon as the war is over, there's never that peace dividend.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, it's an excellent question. And I do serve on two committees, the Armed Services Committee and the Science and Technology Committee. So the kind of two committees on that question, right? The Armed Services, trying to defend the country and working to get the resources for that, and Science and Technology, which is sort of the peace side of that, the space program, scientific research, that sort of thing. And it is a challenge because, first of all, it's interwoven into our economy. And so it's easy to say, well, let's cut defense, you know, we'll slash this program and slash that program, and you do, and suddenly everybody's visiting you saying, well, this is going to cost this many jobs and this many jobs, et cetera. Certainly if we're going to have a strong defense, and that includes things like radars and sonars, and certainly, you know, you can make those arguments, optics and things like that. We produce those in this district, and I want my companies to be producing that. And there's nothing wrong with that if it suits the proper need. But my companies can produce the same thing for peaceful uses, for airplane safety and for exploration of the solar system. In fact, they do. A good portion of the companies that do defense in this area do about half and half, you know. That's actually an economic decision they make because, you know, there are things, defense does go down and then they can work more in the other sectors. But it is a very, very good question. I was visited by a group of people the other day who were sort of talking about this, and they realizing there's jobs here and saying, well, how can we convert these defense jobs into jobs doing things that are more peaceful? And I think there's a lot of ways to do that, but you are going to need a real popular movement behind things. I think I read a recent poll that said 27, maybe it was a little higher than that, so don't quote me on this, but somewhere in the high 20s, low 30% of people think that we should prioritize global climate change issues. That's awfully, awfully low. Science has been clear on this. Global climate change is a real threat. There's no way of knowing for sure that our cold snaps this winter is due to them, but there's many reasons to suspect that it is partly responsible and that they will get much worse if we don't do something. There are a lot of these technologies could be used to improve our environment, both to reduce carbon emissions, but also, remediation. I mean, I do hear sometimes from Republicans say, well, we'll solve that problem if it happens. Well, we've got the technology to help do that. But how do we convert to that kind of economy? I do think there's going to have to be a popular outcry to do so. Certainly transportation. I mean, there's so much infrastructure needs, and yet in the Armed Services Committee, we can pass a bill. In the House Transportation Committee, they can't. And I will tell you this, it is not the committee. The committee can pass a bill, but they can't get it to the floor of the House. The ultra-conservative Republicans won't allow them to. So there are these needs, and I think but I do think there has to be more of a popular outcry in order to get the conversion. But it's certainly possible. Space exploration is another area. We're going to have a summit on green technologies here. But one last point, and that is you talked about a peace dividend when the war is over. We can't have a peace dividend if the war never ends. And in previous years, we've been on a war footing for so long. And we still are. And if you think I'm wrong, you know, talk to Cherie Phillips, who was my guest at the State of the Union Address, who lost her son just last year in a bombing in Afghanistan that killed 5 American soldiers. We are still at war. So part of the reason why we're not getting the peace dividend is because we're still at war.
Thank you very much for your remarks. Back to a local, to two major local issues, one being the graduation rate from high schools. We are on first place on the bottom side, apparently. And the other issue is children poverty. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I do believe they're related, very related, of course. The graduation rate, it worries me. But I do sort of caution people that that's not the only statistic. You know, it matters what Samuel Clemens said, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. So the problem with the graduation rate, of course, is that it's easy to raise the graduation rate. You just lower the standards of the high school or whatever. A lot of high schools have very, very good graduation rates. It doesn't necessarily mean they're good high schools because the kids come in knowing a lot, having, you know, very active parents or whatever, and then they graduate. And we've got schools in Central New York that given the inputs, given the level of education where the children come in on, it is amazing how well they do. And they don't get the credit because they're just measured on graduation rates, test scores, et cetera, the outputs. There's no input there. That said, your point is very well taken. Clearly, we have a challenge in Central New York. We have jobs. There's a lot of openings. This is one of the things you find out when you hold a job fair and when you listen to 150 businesses across 4 counties, is there's actually more openings than one might think. But there's not the people with the training and skills and soft skills. Showing up on time, being able to be, you know, write basic instructions, do reports and things like that are necessary to keep a manufacturing operation going. They're at basic interpersonal skills. There aren't those kind of skills. So we definitely need to improve our schools. I think Say Yes has by and large been a good program, and we need to continue to pursue that. But you need the whole enchilada. Say Yes is not just about not, you know, paying for college if kids go to public schools in the city. It's about the tutoring and the mentoring and all that other stuff. And although that's happened, I don't think anybody involved with Say Yes has said it's happened to the extent that that it was planned to happen. I believe there has to be a federal role. I don't think that you can get the kind of results that we as a nation need to get in order for the economic reasons alone, forgetting for the moment about the fact that our democracy won't run unless people are educated. Thomas Jefferson told us that. Unless you have a stronger commitment, broadly speaking. Our schools are now funded by not the national government, somewhat largely by the state with state aid, but ultimately by the smallest possible government entity. And if you're in a very small school district in, say, Wayne County, and a couple of kids with special needs move in, of course you want to, you know, you have to take care of kids with special needs. It'll break your budget, though. I mean, can you imagine being a superintendent and praying that you don't get special needs children move in your district? It's not enviable. So we need to provide a little bit more than 7 cents on every dollar of school aid from the federal government. And we need to do it with accountability. Right now, you get the standards and all this other stuff. And if the schools do all that, they get a tiny, tiny pittance. A pittance they need, but it's tiny. So we need to make sure that there's some aid to back that up.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the getting a bill out of committee and onto the floor. You mentioned that briefly, and we all learned the high school civics version of it, but I know that's not the real version. And I'm wondering if there's any way that constituents can influence that so we don't continually have a 40-something vote on health care and another vote on anti-abortion instead of the things that we really as constituents care about.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It's a very broad question because what you're talking about is essentially sort of how the institution works. And, you know, there's an argument to be made that the civics lesson that I got it in Schoolhouse Rock, remember the, I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And then the bill went to committee and he was debated and, you know, signed your bill, you're a law. Of course, you know, even at the beginning of the Republic, it wasn't like that. But clearly, the way things work now, a lot of the committee hearings and the markups and doing this bill is kind of kabuki. I mean, it's sort of for the cameras. What really happens is behind the scenes, and it gets farther and farther up. An agreement with Harry Reid and John Boehner, or in the case of the budget, in the case of like the farm bill, you know, one committee chairman in the Senate and maybe a committee chair and ranking member in the House. And to a certain extent, it's always happened that way. But if you want to sort of get rid of the wasting time, it is a matter, I think, of the two things we've already talked about, more people paying attention, who are willing to entertain more of a complex political model than this person is wrong and this person's right, right? That, well, they've got some points and this side has some points. Because two, an education level that really incentivizes people being interested in some of that stuff. Because right now we've got the reason why they have all those votes is because they're playing to their base. But Democrats do the same thing too. We have votes often. We have a vote on the minimum wage, for instance. There was no way that was going to pass. There was no way it was going to go anywhere, et cetera. And we touted that as some big accomplishment. So it's very similar in that, and so there's no simple answer, but again, I think the same thing that will help cure our democracy, being part of the solution, not part of the problem, is also the solution to that. Congress, over time, is reactive to what people want. It is. I mean, it may not be right away. It may not be a particular member, a particular committee, or particular leadership, but over time, I have that confidence.
I just wanted to add, that made me think about a local organization that we have, the Political Leadership Institute, that's part of Leadership Greater Syracuse, that's about to start up a set of classes, and that one part of the solution might be to get more people into office who are interested in the complexities of it. And locally, the Central New York Political Leadership Institute helps to do that. So if you're interested or know someone who is, check it out. Charles.
It seems to me, put your upstate New York hat on and think.
Never take it off.
Good. We've had it for 30 years, we've had an outflow of major headquarters. You think Carrier, you think Krauss Heinz, you think three or four banks. There's an input there from the headquarters that brings in business, okay? Even if it isn't a headquarters here, we've lost huge numbers of people from General Electric, from Carrier, and those are the jobs you're talking about. Is there something that can be done to change that so that we either make it attractive for people to have headquarters here, make it attractive for them to bring back and fill up these empty businesses?
Yes and no. I think that, first of all, putting my Central New York hat on, I do, you know, I look at the rest of the country and a lot of this has happened, particularly in the Northeast, but everywhere. I mean, the era of big, you know, several multi-thousand people factories that you know, produce large quantities of manufactured goods is over in the United States to a large extent. It doesn't mean the era of manufacturing is over. Central New York continues to be a leader in manufacturing. A far greater percentage of our economy is manufacturing than most other parts of the country. But it's a lot different. It's very high tech. It's much fewer people. And that's part of the issue. You could have a plant that would produce as much as Carrier did, that when Carrier had, you know, 7,000 employees, with 500 employees today, maybe even fewer. So it's not just a matter of getting the companies here. It's also a matter of the companies are very, very different and technology is very, very different. Some manufacturing, there's a little real potential for it to move back to the United States from other countries because, as it turns out, the technology is even more important than the cost of the workforce. So sure, countries like China can way, way undercut us in workforce. They don't have really environmental regulations. They don't have intellectual property. They don't float their currency. And even then, sometimes it still makes economic sense because the technology is here. So what we can do is make it a lot more conducive to those kind of high-tech industries. Obviously, worker training and education is a huge piece. They're going to go where the workforce is. Making sure that this is a good place to live. I believe Central New York is the best place to raise a family, to live, to sort of, be. It may not, you know, you want excitement, you can, you know, for a few days, go to New York City or Las Vegas. But if you want to live your life, live it in Central New York. So those intangibles are important. There's things that you can do on the tax structure. Frankly, we do need tax reform. We have a tax structure that, I mean, it'd be like if I pulled out a cell phone and it was this big. I mean, our tax code is from 1986, right? 1986. Well, a lot of things have changed since 1986, particularly in industry. So there are a number of things we can do both on a local and national level. I think we're doing a lot of those things. One of the key things is working very closely with universities and colleges. The educational world, higher education research, is now intimately linked with creating jobs, and that's something we've done. We've done it to try to get this unmanned aerial vehicle, the so-called drone research, to do research in non-military uses for these, including, by the way, I'm hoping we'll be part of writing the rules that keep them from violating our civil rights, because the technology is going to be here just as satellites are and phones and all these different mobile devices. But it doesn't mean we can't have rules to protect our civil liberties. But that kind of research, I think, is key, and partnering with universities and colleges. So I think we're doing a lot. I think we can do more. You know, my grandfather was a plant manager at GM when it was over here, right over here. And so it is hard. I'm a GM family. That was one of the companies. But that era is gone. But it doesn't mean the era of making things and building things and being a center of industry is gone for Central New York.
Speaker Boehner said something recently that I found pretty astonishing. He was talking about the shutdown and said that he didn't really agree with it. But he said as a leader, if he had no followers, he would basically be taking a walk by himself. What surprised me about that is I can't imagine someone like Tip O'Neill or Lyndon Johnson or Nancy Pelosi making a similar statement. So in the interest of candor versus collegiality, I'd like your opinion of Boehner. And also, if his conference is so strong, why haven't the conference members elected someone like an Eric Cantor or Paul Ryan or someone else? Why are they continually returning Boehner to the speakership?
Well, give it time. Actually, I it's hard not to have some empathy for John Boehner. But because I do think that he is in a position of you know, being a leader with very few actual loyal followers that are loyal to him. Largely, I think he remains speaker because nobody else wants the job under these circumstances. They're content to be a lesser target. And I think that, that is part of the problem. I don't believe the Republican Party is healthy at all. In fact, I'm in some ways far more concerned about the Republican Party than I am about the Democratic Party. I'd like us to have in the Democrats. I'm worried about our political strategy, because I think we're talking about the issues, we're working on the issues that people really do care about, and somehow it's not every election translating into electoral victories. And I do think that we have some real we have to think through some of our communication strategies, et cetera. But the Republican Party, I'm very worried about the actual core. You talk to, Central New York Republicans, and I may disagree with them on this issue or that issue, but we at least can have a conversation. You go down to Washington, and there's a lot of these folks, so you can't agree on the same set of facts. Therefore, there's no basis for compromise because, there's no basis of even agreeing on the context. And that is a real challenge. And so, yes, Boehner, it's easy to criticize him, but he was being candid. He wasn't being a strong leader necessarily, but he was being candid. There have been a couple of times recently where I wish he would have just stood up and done the right thing. And if it meant his speakership, it's only a matter of time anyway. And I think for him, would have been a lot better to go out doing the right. Now, he may not have lost it because, as I say, nobody else wants the job right now under these circumstances. But I think it would have been better for him to go out doing the right thing for the country, and then go on a speaking tour and write books and teach and stuff. I do admire him. I disagree with him deeply, but I admire a lot of the things he's accomplished. You shouldn't at some point or another. What did Gandhi say? Even if you're a minority of one, the truth is the truth. So I don't disagree that he may not have any followers, but if it's the right thing to do, it's the right thing to do. And so that's the problem with what he said, I think, is that he's saying, well, I did the wrong thing, but I had to, or nobody would follow me. Look, you got to pick your fights, but there's one or two. You always have to pick one or two. You don't pick everyone, and that may be the Democrats' problem. We pick every fight. But if you should pick one or two.
The Obamacare program has had some difficulties with its rollout, but I'm concerned that you've voted on a number of occasions with Republicans who are trying to modify Obamacare, and I wondered if you'd speak to that as well as address what your assessment is of the new healthcare system that's trying to evolve.
No, thanks, Peter. I'm going to reverse those questions if it's all right with you. So in terms of my assessment of it currently, it's interesting. The reality and the perception are very different. If you look at the reality of the Affordable Care Act,